technology has been a challenge for us. It's a challenge in most schools. How do we integrate it into our teaching? How do we use it to enhance our teaching in the classroom and learning? So that is why I have brought these people today to us. And so I present to you Darren Kirkpatrick.
Before we get started, I'm going to embarrass some of my colleagues. So there's a whole group of us that have come out together, and I'll just take a moment to introduce. There's Howard Griffith, who's in charge of web-based courses, and he's doing special teaching. Rob Fisher's our manager. John Finch, literacy advisor. And Michelle Arroz-Pozenko, also literacy advisor. And we've got another colleague who's working feverishly in one of your labs to prepare outstanding double session for you, John Evans. In his absence. Okay, so today, Technology Day, people often think of that as kind of like an IT day. I should tell you up front, I tend to walk around a lot, so forgive me if I get a little close. So often, Technology Day, people think of that as kind of like an IT professional development day, and I think of it as a TI professional development day. And over the course of this talk, about 45 minutes, I hope that becomes clear to you why I think of it that way. Now, as we get started, I thought we might start with a little prayer, which is something I heard at another conference. The fellow ended his session with this little prayer. Here's how it goes. It says, please, please, don't teach kids for today. Because we're currently living in a world where we are preparing students for jobs that don't yet exist, using technologies that haven't been invented yet, to solve problems that we don't even know are problems yet. So let's first talk a little bit about the context in which we have to teach today, the modern day, because we live in a time of rapid technological change. Now, when the Model T was invented, they didn't call it a car, they didn't call it an automobile, they called it a horseless carriage. And we today live in the time of the horseless carriage. See, at that time, they had no metaphor for what a car was. There was no word to describe what this new technology was all about. And as you'll hear me tell you later, every technology requires a new metaphor. And so when new technologies arise in society, and we struggle to find ways to describe them, we do things like describe them as a horseless carriage. And today, we very much live in the time of the horseless carriage. And when we start looking back, or from the future, when people start looking back at this time, in the same way that we think it's kind of quaint to describe a car as a horseless carriage, well, people will likely think that the technologies that we have today, blogs, wikis, podcasts, smart boards, all the different things that come up, Facebook, they'll think it's kind of quaint that we called it those things, and that we have the attitudes to it that we do. A big piece of the context that we currently teach in is that we're shifting. As technology changes rapidly and it impacts our society to the point where we're starting to live lives face-to-face and online. Not as separate entities, but the lines between them are starting to blur. And we're starting to change from a society where we think of information as something that's in computers to where there's people in the information. So let me kind of flesh that out for you. Watch this.
I'd like to take you on a bit of an expedition into the history of computing, and I'll end up by talking about one unseen but very important part of the future. If you looked at computing in 1900, it was a career. A person who tabulated numbers was called a computer. Fast forward to World War II. We're creating massive, building-sized electronic computers. Our goal was to break ciphers like Enigma, to figure out enemy activities, to save the world from the Nazis. In that era, there were very few electronic computers. This was just a small hill. It was really computing as four or five big calculators. Fast forward to the late 60s and all the way up to today. That's this mountain that we're on right now, and it's big. It started with this idea that you could look into a computer screen and see a place. You had a desktop and some folders and a trash can, and the information was actually in the computer. Today, at the top of this mountain, we have just passed 1 billion internet users. But there's a much bigger mountain ahead. The future isn't going to be billions, but trillions of computers embedded in just about everything. So how big is a trillion? Well, let's count back in seconds. Go back 1 million seconds. that's like maybe a week and a half ago. Go back a billion seconds. Well, that brings us back to the mid-1970s. All right, now go back a trillion seconds. How far back do you think that is? Well, you know, it turns out that it's over 30,000 years ago. So trillions of computers. This is not computing as a place or computing as a big calculator. It's going to be computing as an ecology. It's all around us, not information in the computers, but people in the information. I don't mean trillion, by the way, like the way we think about big deficit. That's about a trillion $1 bills that are all the same. Not some things that are all connected or sending you spam or affected by a worm or asking for today's update. This is a big challenge. This is going to create whole new industries, and other businesses are just going to disappear overnight. So why do I say that? Let's go back to the current mountaintop. Many leaders see the mountain ahead. After all, it is huge. But many of them have confused a good view for a short distance. They try to get to the other mountain by building fire towers and rickety bridges in the hopes that they can get there from here using their existing ways of thinking. But they can't. You really have to climb the other side. You've got to start designing for trillions. It's totally different and bigger challenge, frankly, than humankind has ever faced. But even though we haven't solved the problem of trillions, nature has. Your own body has trillions of cells. It's a complicated information system in its own right. In your body, you have atoms, which make up molecules, which make up cells, which make up organs, and those make up systems, which make up you, and then we together make up us, and groups of us make up communities. Nature uses layered complexity, and it also uses some other proven building blocks. They're all unseen, they're invisible. And there's no doubt that trillions are possible and represent the future information age to come.
So we're living in a society where the interaction between what we do online and offline is changing very rapidly. How many of you have seen this, Wolf from Alpha? One, two, three. Okay, this is the start of something that's described as the semantic web. The semantic web is the web of things. When things start talking to each other, it's almost as though ideas or objects on the internet can interact with each other. This is not a search engine. This is what's called a computational engine. So I'm going to show you, if you haven't seen this, this is something you need to get your head around. It's not a search engine, it's called a computation engine. So anything that you enter into this search engine, it's going to try to do some kind of calculation on it. And this is not just for the math teachers, but maybe I'll start off with the math teachers. So if I type in an expression like a half times x plus 6, which is often taught in grade 6 math. Kids struggle with that. Well, when I put that into Wolfram Alpha, what comes back, I apologize if you can't see. Here we go. So it comes back with, it says it understands the input over here is x plus 6. It's drawn two different graphs. It says it's the geometric figure of a line. It's given an alternate form, and it says x equals negative 6. As a math teacher, if you send kids home to do a stencil with a bunch of calculations, how do you know they did? Because all they have to do is punch pretty much any question into there, and it's going to give them not just the answer, but the right answer. And even as the math gets even more advanced, so I'm going to put in some kind of crazy calculus problem. So this is the integral of sine to the 4th x cos to the 4th x dx, and what it does is it instantly gives me the answer. But it does more than that. It gives me a plot of the answer, two different graphs, it gives me other advanced calculus, etc. But you know what's key about this is there's a link here, I'm not sure if you can see it, it says show steps. Well, when you punch a problem into Wolfram Alpha, it shows you the steps, and what we've got here is step by step how that integral was solved with brief explanations of how that's done. And if you're teaching, if you're preparing your lessons and you want to put this stuff into your lesson, we'll just click on it, drag it to your desktop, and then drag it into your document, including the solution. If you want the whole solution, you just take it over here, drag it onto your desktop, and then there it is. And so you can zoom in and show you what the answer looks like, but you get the idea. Now, this is not just for math teachers. Guinness, I know it in people's way. I'll move out of the way in just a second. Let's say you're teaching social studies or you're teaching history. One of the things you might do is you might want to kind of look, what happens if you type in Canada? But a more interesting thing might be to type in Canada and another country. In this case, in my school, we're about 33% of the school is English as an additional language. And the source of most of our new students, our EAL students, tends to be from Africa, from all over. So we have a number of Kenyan students, for example. So this becomes kind of relevant. If you've got kids in your classroom from other countries, what you might want to do is type in Canada and the country they're from, and kind of show people what's the relationship between those two countries. So here's Canada and Kenya. There's the their internet codes, there's their flags, but now over here, the geographic properties. So Canada has 9.9 million square kilometers in area, and Kenya has 582,000. Very big difference in what they've got. But if you look at the populations, Canada's 33.3 million and Kenya 38.8. Close, but Kenya's got a little more than we do. More than that, if we look down, the population density in Canada is 3.6 people per square kilometer. In Kenya, 68 people per square kilometer. No value judgments here. I'm just reporting the facts. If you know the population growth in Canada is 0.97%, but in Kenya it's 2.36. Can you think of an interesting question to ask your students based on that? Life expectancy in Canada is 81.2 years. In Kenya, it's 57.9. Any other interesting questions that arise from those facts? The median age in Canada is 40, but in Kenya, it's 18.7 years. Now, if you want to know more, then there's a button here that says show rates. Well, when I ask it to show the rates, it's going to give me things like the birth rate, the death rate. More interesting questions come from this. Now, one of the sessions later today, we'll talk about we'll talk about good questions. So anyways, and it goes on and on and on. Let's say you're teaching something out of history, and let's say you're teaching, well, I don't know, maybe it's World War I. So if I type in World War I, I'm going to get all sorts of things about the historical event World War I. It gives me the dates, tells me all the countries that were involved, and the people that were involved, the key figures in World War I. One of them was Archduke Franz Ferdinand. When I click on that, oh, here's Woodrow Wilson, who was also a key figure in World War I. When I click on his name, it does a search on his name and tells me all sorts of things about Woodrow Wilson. This is true for all the personalities that came up in the search. That's if you're teaching history. What if you're teaching science? So if you're teaching science and you send kids home, and you ask them to balance a bunch of chemical equations, let's say if you're teaching chemistry. So H plus N equals NH4, that's not a balanced equation. If you send kids home and you ask them to solve the balanced equation, the first thing it does is it finds out all the things, and then it actually balances the equation. Hold on a second. It balanced the equation this morning.
It's a reminder.
There it is. Yeah. It's hard to see because of the resolution, but there's actually a plus sign here and an equals sign or an arrow here. Now, if you need this equation in your planning for your lesson, we can just drag it and drop it in. But it also tells me all sorts of other things. It puts hydrogen and nitrogen up against each other. Gives me the structure diagram. General properties, etc., thermodynamic properties. You can get a picture of the molecule and drag that in, etc. So what does all this mean for us as teachers? Because in math, if I'm going to send them home with exercises to do, what exercises am I going to send them home to do if I just type it into Wolfram Alpha? What does homework mean? Well, it's not that it doesn't mean anything. It means that we have to ask different questions. The questions, yeah, the work has to be valid, but now we can ask questions that force the kids to think at a higher cognitive level. When I started off, I typed in an expression for you math teachers, a half times x plus 3. The question isn't to balance the equation or to solve the expression. It actually turns that expression into an equation And for math teachers, it's a bit technical, but there was no equal sign there. Why did it give us an equal sign? When you type that expression into Wolfram Alpha, it gave us five different outputs. Different ways of writing the expression, two graphs, something called a root. Why did it do that? What are the five outputs that Wolfram Alpha gives us, and can you explain the significance of each one? That might be a good homework question. Why did Wolfram Alpha give us an equation when we didn't type in an equation? An expression and an equation are different things. Chemistry teachers, if you're going to send them home with some chemical equations to balance, the question might not be, can you balance these equations? The question might be, can you game the system? You know what the correct balanced equation is. How many wrong equations with those two chemicals can you enter into Wolfram Alpha so that it still gets the right answer? And what's the tipping point? When does it give us a different molecule? What's that? Because as they engage with the material in this way, then they start thinking at a higher cognitive level. You all heard of Bloom's taxonomy. It was updated in 2000, right? It was supposed to move from remember basic facts and understand and apply, synthesize, and at the very top is create content. Yes?
I just wanted to get to sort of clarifying the difference between the search engine, because we also have, I'm not saying that it's a linear search engine and this competition engine, so that for me, for example, if I typed in, I would be able to type in that equation to Google, for example.
Right.
It would be even something else would come up.
Yeah.
So would you be able to sort of define those?
Sure. Right here? At the moment, this is one of a kind. There's no other computation engine out there, okay, that I'm aware of. Wolfram Alpha is, the back end of Wolfram Alpha is something called Mathematica, which is a math science software. Mathematica is an incredible, it's very expensive, it's very, it's a very sophisticated bit of software that costs a lot of money to buy. Now it's free, right? Because you just type whatever you would use Mathematica for, this will do it for you. The inventor of Mathematica, what's his name, Wolfram, I forget his first name. Anyways, he's the guy behind Wolfram Alpha, and it's not a search engine, it's a computation engine. So you're not going to get the same kind of results that you would get, say, in Google that you'll get here. Whatever you type in here, it's going to try to come up with some kind of calculation on it. When did this occur in time? How much of these? How many? When? Stuff like that. My suggestion to you would be to play with them. You need to spend whatever you teach, if you want to see some examples of what it's going to look like in your area, well, when you land on Wolfram Alpha, there's a link at the top that says examples. Now, when you click on the examples, again, the screen's not very dark, so it's hard to see, but it's got examples from mathematics, from statistics and data analysis, physics, chemistry, astronomy, all the life sciences, technology, transportation, web units and measures, money and finance, colors, music, sports and games, education, people and history, culture and media, world linguistics, food, nutrition, health, weather, socioeconomic data, places, geography, dates, times, visual gallery of examples. Whatever you teach, you're going to find something there that you'll be able to use in a meaningful way. But you need to get your head around it. You need to spend some time. My friend John walked in. John likes to describe it as sustained tinkering time. Right, STT. We all need some STT. We know our students need it to help them learn. We need it no less, right? Okay, so I'm going to go on.
This is going to be a lightning
course. So what is the world like when things talk to each other? The world, the web of things. Well, let's say you're at the airport and you get a message on your text, on your phone from your wife because she says, don't forget the dinner tonight. Now the guy you're sitting next to mistakenly grabs your bag because it looks the same as yours. And your cell phone goes off because things talk to each other. It says, I'm not near you anymore. So he sees the tag and he goes looking for the fellow because the cell phone's detecting his bag. Meanwhile, shopping at the store with your little girl, you're looking for the wine. Not sure where it is, you touch the wine and a little map comes up and tells you where to find it. While you were trying to get the wine, your little girl loses her teddy bear. She doesn't know where it is. Things talk to each other, so you pull out your mobile internet device, and it detects where the teddy bear is. You start wandering through the store to find him. If you're a doctor, your mobile device recognizes you to get in the room and gives you all the information you need about the patient that you're going to serve. You also get a text. It's your sister. Don't forget dinner tonight. Can't get into his computer. How come is that? Meanwhile, the fellow who lost it finds him. Because his mobile internet device showed him where it was. We're still looking for the teddy bear back in the store. Where could it possibly be? Oh, down this aisle. Yeah, she left it inside the freezer. How would you have found that? Okay, what am I going to wear today? Well, let's see. Oh, I think I like this dress. Now, I have so many shoes. Which one would go with this dress? Well, let's go over to our computer and say, for this dress, which shoes match?
Oh, hallelujah!
Dinner. You open the door, there's your sister, she comes in. When she closes the door, her cell phone goes off because it realizes that her husband is only meters away from the house. 5 meters, 4, 3. We don't like that one. Teddy bear again, so Dad gives her a little wristband, a little bracelet that will help her find it. And so anytime she loses her teddy bear, she can find it herself now. So that's the web of things. That's the context in which we now live and teach. Now we're not quite there yet in that video that I just showed you, but it's not that far. Have you ever heard of this thing called an RFID device? Okay, RFID. Not something you need to quite know about yet, but what it is, radio frequency identification device. So how does Walmart know when they're out of stock? Because all the pallets have these little chips embedded on them. When the number of, every time you go, you know, they scan your stuff when you leave the store. And when you leave the store, the computer registers that we're now out of this stock. So an order is automatically placed for new stock. Where in the world is the, well, your cell phones and the GPS devices? It's getting to the point where you can start tracking things. I know there's one service that you can subscribe to that if you're interested in Italian restaurants, as you're walking through the city, your cell phone will go off when you're near one. So when it comes to literacy with ICT, and when we think about literacy, we have to move beyond teaching kids about literacy to start teaching them about fluency, because if all your kids can do is read and write, they're not going to be literate. Teaching kids beyond literacy means that literacy generally thinks is about, I reach for a tool and I use it today. What does it look like today? Do I know how to use it? Do I know the ins and outs of using that device? But being fluent is kind of the way you reach for a pen today. If I gave you a pencil, if I gave you a pen, if I gave you a marker, a crayon, you'd know what to do with it, regardless of what the tool looks like. But with technology, those tools are changing fast. How many of you have seen the brand new, the newest version of Word? The very newest version of Word?
Probably
it was much more. Yeah. It came out 2010, I think. Okay, it came out this year. So if you're comfortable using Word, with you click on a menu and you pull down commands from a menu, the new Word is different. The new Word is actually made up of what they call ribbons. Okay? It's a completely different interface. So to moving beyond literacy to fluency means that you teach kids the skills they need, not just to use the tool as it was designed today, because the tools that we're using today, even our cell phones, well, the cell phone that you have today is not the cell phone you had 5 years ago. Do you remember how big those were? And you know how small they are today? All they did five or 10 years ago, all you could do with a cell phone was talk. That's it. That's the least of the things you can do with a cell phone today. Okay? So it's not just a matter of finding, moving from literacy to fluency means that as the tools change, I should be able to quickly adapt. Same like when I get on a bike. If you learn how to ride a bike as a kid and you haven't been on it for years, you get back on the bike, and while you may fall once or twice, you'll very quickly kind of pick it up again. The body remembers. Right? How many of you know your best friend's telephone number? Or does your finger know your best friend's telephone number? How many of you know where your best friend lives? You know the address, or you just know how to get there? Right? But you know what I mean, right? We go through this with our kids. So that's fluency. That's fluency. Those are the kind of skills that kids need. So that's the context in which we teach, and now I'm going to tell you three stories. The first story I'm going to tell you is about wolves. And we have to learn to be like the wolves. I'll tell you what I mean by that. You may not know what when wolves battle for nomads, and they do this regularly on a daily basis, will hover over the losing wolf. The losing wolf lies down and bares its neck to the winning wolf. Seems like a ridiculous thing to do. As long as the losing wolf bears its neck and remains prone, the winning wolf won't touch it. It will snarl and growl and walk around. If the losing wolf stands up, then they're fighting again. But as long as it lies down on the ground, exposing its neck, the winning wolf will not touch the losing wolf. Because with wolves, their tools, their nails, their claws, their weapons, have evolved hand in hand with their society and their culture. So as their tools became more dangerous and more threatening, their culture evolved to make sure that they don't kill each other. Unfortunately, we're not like the wolves. The first thing we tend to do with most technologies is how to break things with it, or how to hurt each other. With nuclear technology, the first use we came up with it was a bomb. There are many, many other more interesting uses of technology. One of the first uses we come up with for using the internet is to say nasty things about each other, or to go off the deep end and spout off about something that we're upset about. This past winter, there were two girls in Lord Selkirk School Division, was reported in the Sun. Over the winter holiday, two girls were harassing another 14-year-old girl and actually made death threats to her. Now, this happens outside of school. Right? They come back to school the next day. The mom of the girl who had been threatened reports this to the school, and the school gets involved, and the two girls who are uttering death threats get suspended from school. It says at the bottom there, they had no idea the impact their words would have. Now, in a radio interview, the superintendent says, you see, if this is something that had happened at school, well, we could have protected them. Because we have filters and we have walls where kids can't get to things like Facebook and stuff like that. But do you see the irony in this? At the very top of the article in the Sun, all the tools that they're saying they want to prevent kids from using in school, the Sun is using to get the information out to the world at large. Is it really true that if we block them off from access to these tools and technologies in school, that they're going to go home and use them responsibly? Because they are going to have access to them there. And if they don't learn in school, if their teachers can't teach them, then where are they going to learn how to use not just the mechanics of the tool? I talked about moving from literacy to fluency. I don't just mean mechanics. A big part of using a new tool is learning how to use it responsibly and ethically. Here's another example. And when I talk about ethics to teachers today, there's an elephant in the room. And the elephant is an event that happens. You may have seen the video from Churchill High School. Okay? So what happens? So the two teachers do this make this breathtaking error. Okay? And it gets now, if there hadn't been cell phones before, if there hadn't been any technology to capture the event, it probably would have blown over, it would have been dealt with locally, and that would have been the end of it. But because of things like cell phones and all the rest, it goes global, it goes viral, it's all over the world. This girl realizes there's something wrong. If you saw the video, this girl pokes her head in at the end and says, that's wrong. And the kids recognize that, you know, there's something wrong with that. My concern is that people look at that situation and says, okay, having the cell phones in the school, if there hadn't been cell phones, that wouldn't have been a problem. So you know what? No cell phones in school. Because that's the problem, right? If no cell phones, no problem. So if we remove the tool, then we've solved that problem. It can't happen again. Of course, I would say that's the wrong way to go. It's kind of like, so when your kids pass notes in class, you take away their pencils? Or you say, is this a technology problem? Or is this a classroom management problem? Or in that case, is it a problem of ethics? On the part, in this case, of the teachers and also of the students. See, I would say that we should, not only should you have cell phones in school, but you should have, they should be all over the school. This is a quote from Marshall McLuhan. They are. We shape our tools and then our tools shape us. And if you think about the cell phone, that's really true. Like, when I was a kid and I wanted to meet my friends after school or on the weekend to go somewhere, like, we had to know, like, at what time, exactly where, and I'll meet you there. I will be at that spot at that time. We don't do that now. We do proximity dating, right? You say, well, you know, I'll kind of be in the Polo Park area. Call me when you're around, right? Where do you want to go for dinner? Oh, I don't know. There's some good stuff around Osborne. Let's, or Corridor. Let's go to Corridor. Not which restaurant, not which street, and I'll call you. We built our tools, and then our tools changed the way that we interact with each other. That's not like the wolves. Right? With the wolves, they go hand in hand. It's endemic. That's who we are. That's how we are. We build our tools, and our tools shape us. But shouldn't we have a more considered and a more careful, a more thoughtful approach to how these tools are used by us and by our children? In our classrooms, we need to learn to be like the wolves, to try to evolve our uses of technology and tools, because that's all they are. The problem is not the technology. And locking technology out of your classrooms and out of your schools isn't going to solve the problem. The technology is not going away. It's immersive. I hesitate to say this. It may be a little provocative. My thinking about this has evolved over some time, and I'm getting to the point now where I think that if you're not making a meaningful use of technology in some way with your students in your classes, you might be doing active harm to your students. Because that's not the world they live in. That's not the world they're going to live in. It's not the world they're going to work in. And if we don't take the time to teach them how to use those tools in a responsible and ethical way, then they may do what those two girls did and utter death threats online because they haven't, there's no responsible person looking over their shoulder and saying, here's how to use the tool mechanically, but there's all this other stuff too that you need to know about. Yes?
So in a family environment, we raise our children and it's a building process, but they learn from the beginning. So would it not make sense then that this teaching, this responsible use of technology, should begin in kindergarten, grade one, so that by the time I have them, they already have the ethical basics.
Yes.
So my question is then, with their not teaching any kind of technology lessons in the lesser grades, that must be happening, I'm making an assumption here, because the students I have at the higher grades are totally inadequate in being able to use some of the technology. They've got it, they're at home, they dabble, they do this or that. But we don't teach technology any longer. The subject teacher is expected to do that. So I, in effect, now have a student that's come through 6-7 years, and she hasn't been taught those ethics that are there.
Mm-hmm.
She hasn't taught how to use all those different things. And that I find is, it's
okay.
two
problems. First, you shouldn't be teaching technology. Technology should be like oxygen. Ubiquitous, necessary, and omnipresent. And visible. And you're right that you've all heard of this, the digital natives, if you heard that expression, digital natives, digital immigrants, right? It's the idea that kids today, they're digital natives. They just inherently know how to use technology, and us older folks are the digital immigrants. We're late to the game. We're just starting to get our heads around it. Okay, that's a lot of hope. Some kids are digital natives. So are some adults. Some kids are digital immigrants. And we're living in a time of transition. So yeah, you're going to have kids in your classes that have had the experience using the technology, and you're also going to have kids in your classroom that haven't had the technology. I was mentioning to you that about a third of the students at the school I taught at were EAL students coming from Africa. Many of them, some of them have access to technology, many of them don't. And their first experience with formal education happens in grade 10. Never mind all the other things, with technology and language and all the rest. So that's going to be a push and pull you we're going to have to deal with on an ongoing basis.
So when do they learn the keyboard?
Well, it's going to change with every kid, right? The kids that have access to keyboards early will learn to use keyboards. The kids that don't, then we're going to have to teach them that.
How about the kids that have access to keyboards early and still haven't actually grade 10? Because keyboarding is not taught.
Well, that's a conversation that you need to have in your school. If that's a need that you've identified in your school, then you've got to figure out in which curriculum, where does it make sense for us to look at that more closely.
So I guess my question is, why hasn't that been evolved from grade 1 on, so by the time we get them, that 70-80% of them know how to keyboard?
Well, in a lot of classrooms that's true, right? A lot of classrooms teachers are teaching keyboarding. But you also have kids coming in at different grades and backgrounds.
Of course.
So it's that problem's not going to go away. You're still going to have to deal with it somehow. Like I said, like that's really a conversation you need to have internally about where in our system are we going to make that work, that particular issue. I'll talk to you more about it in a minute. Have you seen this?
Yes.
Everyone seen this?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's about half of you that haven't seen it. I'll show you this because my kids came into class one day and they showed me this. So I'll let you watch just 2 minutes of that.
Yeah, I know. How did it go?
I didn't feel anything.
Yeah. Kind of felt good, didn't it?
Is this real life?
Yeah, this is real life.
Okay, now I have 2 fingers.
Good.
4 fingers.
4 fingers? Nah. Don't put it in your mouth. Okay? You feel good?
I can't see anything.
Yes, you can. Stay in your seat. You don't? No?
Do you want stitches?
Yes.
On my teeth?
Yeah, don't touch it. Don't.
Why can't I touch it?
Because it'll mess up the stitches.
Your forearm.
Yeah. It's okay, bud. It's just from the medicine. Okay?
Are you swimming me forever?
No. No, it won't be forever.
So, you can probably figure out from the context, right? So, David has to have some dental surgery. Mom couldn't be there, so Dad takes a little bit of a video of it and to share it with Mom. Now, this was done innocently. Right? The idea was just to share with Mom an experience that she otherwise wouldn't be able to participate in. And they decide to post it to YouTube, thinking that, well, who's going to look at the little video of, you know, my boy having gone to visit the dentist? And when my students found this video, when it first hit the internet, it went viral. Everybody was sharing this video and talking about it and having a good laugh around it and all the rest. And they came into class and showed me this, and I had seen it before they showed it to me, and I was watching them all laughing. And I was looking at David, and I started to think, you know, I wonder what this is going to look like from David's point of view 10 years from now. I wonder, like, David's a little boy, looks to be about 8 or 9 years old, right? What's it going to look like to David when David's in grade 7? When, you know, everything matters about how others see you. right? It's how you get along with everybody. It's the entire social interaction, the social circle that you move in. And is this going to get passed around the school? And is this the impression his classmates are going to have of David? And did his parents? I don't think they did anything malicious. I don't think they were trying to do something harmful to him. I think they were just trying to share something private. Did the parents think about how this is going to impact David 7 years from now? Because literacy is about today, fluency is about today and tomorrow. Right? Well, what happens is it goes viral, and they end up building this website called Dad, David After Dentist. And now you can get merchandise. There's t-shirts, it says, is this real life? You can get stickers. The family will actually, they've done subsequent videos about it. They'll come out to your organization, give a talk. So at first, when they went commercial, there was a lot of questions about that. Now they give the money away for kids that have something called hyperdontia, who have a cleft palate, and they can't afford to have that repaired. And that's where they give money. But still, right? Is this, based on that one video going viral, they've kind of turned it into something of an enterprise. Maybe a not-for-profit enterprise, but still. And I'm still thinking about David in the future. So I'm still wondering, like, is that so funny anymore? Because when I watch that video now, it bothers me. Because if it was my son, I don't think I would want that on the internet. And that's something kids don't understand. That when you put something on the internet, it stays on the internet forever. And when you put something on the internet, it's kind of like gathering the entire school community in the gym. And I mean the community, right? Not just students and teachers. Their families, their parents, the surrounding people. Bring them all in and take the kid with a megaphone, standing in the center of the floor, and let them shout out whatever it was they were going to put on the internet. Because when you put something on the internet, that's what you're doing. You're putting it out there for the whole world to see. So should you be doing that? My answer is yes. You definitely should be doing that, but you should be selective in what you publish. The private stuff, personal stuff, stays personal. Public stuff should be public. Let me tell you a little bit of the backstory to this. It's a little video. There's a grade 5 choir in New York. And the teacher in this class, just every time the kids learn a new song, they take a little video of it while the kids sing the song. And they have a blog, and they publish the video on the blog. And so all the kids' parents in the community, they can come in and see the kids singing and see what that looks like. And here, right? So here's this teacher who's just sharing the good stuff that is going on in his classroom. And here's one of those videos.
Hey, this is me. This comes to you.
Watch their bodies, look at how they sway. Is it authentic? favorite part of the video, right? That last where the teacher looks in the camera and says, that was good, right? Like, there's obviously a lot of positive emotion. Like, he loves those kids. Those kids love him. One little girl in the front row says, I build my love upon you, and points at him, right, during the video. And he's just sharing the good stuff that's going on in his class. Well, it's Landslide, right, by Stevie Nicks. It hits YouTube, and Stevie Nicks' manager, when they're on tour, shows her the video. She watches it twice, crying both times. The kids get invited to Madison Square Gardens to perform for Stevie Nicks, which they do. And Stevie stands there conducting the class, watching the kids sing. When they were finished, Stevie goes up on stage and she goes to each and every kid. The stage manager says, okay, get them out of here, we got a show. She says, no, leave them alone. She goes back up onto stage, goes to each and every kid and says, dreams can come true. Hang on to your dreams. Can you imagine if Stevie Nicks said this to you when you were a kid? Right? The one comment by all the kids afterwards, the most common thing they said was, she smells so nice. That's not a lesson you can plan for. You cannot plan your classes so that that happens. But when you publish the good stuff that your kids are doing online and share that with the world, then you open the door on serendipity and really wonderful things can happen. And teaching the distinction between what we share and what we don't share is an important skill that we all need to learn. I'm just thinking about those two teachers with the, you know, with the lap dance. If they had been publishing all their good stuff online, all the great stuff, because when the media frenzy hit and everybody went searching for stuff about them, and all they found was maybe one provocative picture of that young lady and not much else. If they had found a whole bunch of really good stuff, good work they've been doing with kids for years, maybe that incident would have stood out as a sore thumb, as an exception to the rule, may have actually protected them in some way. Second story. I think we need to learn to be Russian. Circa 1980. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Lawrence Lessig is the lawyer who's behind the Creative Commons movement. If you don't know what that is, that's another thing we need to get our heads around. But anyways, he's on that train. He's a young student. He's in Russia. He's visiting Russia with the visiting professor. And he's sitting next to him. They're talking. And he says, oh, you Americans, circa 1980, the wall hasn't come down. You think that when you read the newspaper, you guys know what's going on in the world. You don't know anything. We in Russia, we have much more authentic understanding of what's going on in the world than you Americans ever possibly could. Circa 1980, the wall hasn't come down? Doris looks at him and says, what do you mean? Like, all of your newspapers are edited and filtered and, you know, like, you don't get the news as it's reported. We do in America. He says, there you go. That's the point. You guys think that what you're reading in your newspapers is real. See, we know they're lying to us. So every newspaper we read, we're trying to distill the truth out of that. Whereas you don't bother, and so it's easy for them to lie to you. So we need to teach kids that critical analysis of content. I got this email, it's a couple of years back now. I got an email that said that you, hello Darren, the online education database just named its top 100 education blogs. And I'm pleased to inform you that A Difference, that's the name of my blog, has made the list. The full list is available here for your perusal. Congratulations. Sounds like I got an award. Cool. Well, I went and I did some digging. I went to Google and I looked up who's this Jimmy Atkinson is the fellow that signed it. And I kind of say, well, okay, there's all this stuff mostly about marketing. Then I go to the OEDB and I start looking at it at a place called Easy Who Is. Who owns that website? And I found that it was owned by a company called Dot Marketer. Dot Marketer, what's that all about? So in the Google list, Dot Marketer was one of the things that came up in the search, and another thing that came up in the search was another website called Six Sigma, a business company. Well, what's the education blogs and top 100 and so on? So then I go to something called the Internet Archive, which takes a record of every website on the internet and makes an archive of it through history. And I go back and I find the OEDB used to be the Oahu, it wasn't education, it was the Oahu experience, you know, there was some kind of tourist thing. And then after that, it was the outdoor education something. And then, about 3 months before he sent me this email, he got the ownership of the site. He's been in business 3 months. anyways, I go do some more digging and finally realize that this top 100 list is really Jimmy's list of faves. Jimmy likes my what? That's wonderful. Jimmy likes my blog. That's great. But I didn't get any big award. It seemed to me that understanding that distinction was important. And I wrote up all the steps that I took to figure that out and shared that with my students. Because that critical analysis of content is important. That's part of what we need to learn and teach kids. This is some questions I asked on Twitter when I said I was going to talk to a group of teachers. Alec Kouros is a professor of education, University of Regina. When I asked him, what should I share with teachers? He says, teachers should be sure that students understand their personal information. Free applications and services aren't really free. The information that you put on the internet stays there forever. And then when the site says that it's free, well, they're still getting your eyes on the prize, right? Selling you ads, maybe. Jacques Kuhl works at the Ministry of Education in Brunswick. He said, assume your digital footprint. You are what you publish. That you should know what it is that you're putting online, because in the future, your digital footprint's going to carry more weight than a resume. If you think you haven't been Googled, you're probably wrong. And if you have been Googled, what was found about you? Did you put it there? Or did someone else? Can you take control of that? Yeah, you can. See, because if you Google me, first three pages is all stuff that either I put there or other people are talking about stuff that I put online. Because for about 5 years now, I've been publishing a torrent of all of my professional stuff, this presentation included, will be online. Because I want people to find the good stuff that I'm doing. Are you in control of your digital footprint? I do want to take questions, but unfortunately I have to save them to the end because we're running short on time. The second question I asked them is what else should teachers know about? Well, avoiding discussing social media, and teachers should be part of the policy making for filtering or blocking. We need to get our head down and set, right? Not talking about it isn't going to fix it. Every technology needs a new metaphor. Smart boards often is a good example of that, because they call it a board. It's not a board. If you ever pick up the eraser and you touch the board, right, you get the eraser looks like a chalk, old style chalk eraser that's made from plastic. Because it's not an eraser, it's a metaphor. If you touch the board, it's a circle, not a rectangle. Right? It's not really a board either. People write on a board and then you erase it because you run out of space. But with digital ink, you don't need to erase any of the students' work. You just make a new page. Paper weighs stuff and costs money. Digital ink, well, once you've got it, you just add a page. It costs nothing, it weighs nothing, right? I think of an interactive whiteboard as kind of a window. Window onto the world. I can pull in any relevant issue and talk about it in class and bring it to my students' attention, but also to two-way window. You know, they can take what's happening in class, the daily lessons, and publish that online so the kids have access to them, but so do their parents. What did you learn in school today? Nothing. Well, no, it says here on the blog you did this. Can you tell me a little more about this? I see this in what you learned in class today. Every technology needs a new metaphor, and the heavy lifting is figuring out what's the appropriate metaphor. If you missed the lyrics to the song that I just played, these are them. So a friend of mine, Bud the teacher, says that if you're about pushing kids' stuff out there, we can't say we need lots and lots of data to measure student growth out one side of our mouths and say their work isn't precious at the other side. If they're doing that work in class, then it should be preserved and shared. And push yourself. And if we're only asking kids to do meaningless stuff, then I want that documented too, so we can change. Everything you do in class should be shared. If it shouldn't be, then why are you doing it? When you design your assignments, ask yourself, how will the assignment talk back? Because it shouldn't be a dead end kind of thing. It should go back and forth. Last story, and I'll wrap it up. You've heard this story about the bundle of sticks, maybe. It's from, I think it's Grimm's Fairy Tales. There's a father near the end of his life, and he's dying. He's on his deathbed. His sons arguing constantly, bitterly, with each other. And so he calls them to his deathbed. He says, I'd like you to bring with me, each of you bring a stick. And they bring a stick to his deathbed, and he says, tie them up in a bundle. Which they do. And then he says to the oldest, take the bundle and break it over your knee. He takes this bundle of sticks and he tries, and he can't break it over his knee. Each son tries in turn, he can't. He says, okay, undo the bundle, take the sticks out, each of you take one, break that stick, which they do easily. He says, because together, you are much stronger than any of you will ever be apart. I actually gotta go past this one, but it's the notion of community. The idea that, and community is a big deal. In our classes, we need to build environments where kids feel that I'm not doing this for marks. I'm doing this because I want to help my friends succeed. How do you build that sense of community in your classroom? And geese, I think, are a perfect example, particularly in Winnipeg. You see them flying a V pattern? Do you know why they do that?
Yeah.
Some people do. The lead goose, when they flap its wings, it gives a little bit of lift to the geese just behind them. Right? And so those geese get a little bit of a push, and so on each goose behind the other. And so they can travel much farther. Of course, it puts a lot of pressure on that lead goose. So throughout the flight, the geese are constantly changing position. Different people take the lead at different times. Don't think of geese, think of your classrooms. Sometimes when the geese land, it looks like this, it's chaotic. Each person does their own thing and they land, and sometimes you need to do your own thing too. When it comes time to land and arrive, then you have to be able to do some things on your own. But by and large, for the most part, you should be working together. There's a teacher who begins in an elementary school, who begins her classes every year like this. She says to the students, what questions do you have about your world and about yourself? And the kid says, well, can I ask silly questions? Is that okay? And she says, it's a question you have about your world or about yourself, and it's not a silly question. And they gather lists of questions, and then they organize them and say, well, these kind of go together, and these. And when they're done, there's the math curriculum. There's the science curriculum. There's the social studies curriculum. There's the LA curriculum, and so on and so forth. Now, I could not do that myself, but it might be a goal for others to aspire to, that we can build our classrooms with that sense of community where the kids have that vested interest in helping each other out and succeeding. I've told you three stories this morning. The first story was about the wolves. I told you about the Russians, and I told you about the bundle of sticks. Well, the wolves, that's really a story about technology. And the story about the Russians, well, that's really a story about content and developing a critical eye toward the information that we're told. And lastly, the bundle of sticks, that's a story about pedagogy. It's about how we teach. It's how we work in our classroom. And all of that takes place in a context, which I told you about at the beginning. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the total package. We live in the intersection of those three things. And as you go through today, thinking of in all the different sessions that you're looking at, learning all the different ideas about different technologies you might be able to use in your classrooms, ask yourself how these things are going to relate to each other. It's not just content, it's not just pedagogy. There's a technological component as well, and they all interact with each other. And we live in the center of that diagram, which means we've got a wicked problem to solve. It's not easy. And you're only going to only figure it out by working together and talking to each other. And if I have one suggestion for you today, this is it. Teach them the interdependence of those three things and to be interdependent upon each other. Because when kids, when we work together, we're always much stronger together than we'll ever be apart. Thanks.